Imagine you're plunging down this pitch black well, and you have absolutely no idea where the bottom is.
Right, none at all.
You don't know if you're about to hit solid rock and just, shatter into a thousand pieces. You are entirely suspended in this literal and, I guess, metaphorical unknown.
Yeah, complete void.
Exactly. But instead of screaming or like bracing for this fatal impact, you are frantically trying to remember if it's considered polite to drop an empty jar of orange marmalade.
Which is just the most absurd, perfect detail.
It really is. So, welcome to the ultimate survival guide for an illogical world. Today, we are opening up a Clarence Horatio companion conversation all about Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and we are completely discarding the notion that this is some dusty, whimsical children's fairy tale.
Yeah, we really need to throw that idea out.
Right. We are exploring this text as a profoundly resonant manual for navigating a reality where the rules just shift without warning, where the people in charge speak in this looping jargon and where your own sense of logic is just constantly under attack.
And that orange marmalade detail you mentioned, it's the perfect entry point because it strips away all that that psychedelic baggage that movie adaptations have kind of heaped onto this story for the last century.
Oh, for sure. The movies make it all about the visuals.
Right. But when you return to the actual source text, the inciting incident is shockingly grounded in this mundane bureaucratic anxiety. I mean, Alice follows a white rabbit down a hole, and as she falls, she notices the sides of the well are filled with cupboards and bookshelves.
Just normal house things in a terrifying death drop.
Exactly. And she grabs a jar labeled orange marmalade, but it's empty. And her immediate overriding concern is that if she drops it, she might kill somebody underneath her.
Which is so considerate, but also entirely irrational given the circumstances.
Right. So she carefully places it into another cupboard as she falls past it. The sheer physics of managing to place a jar into a cupboard while in free fall is just completely ignored. The social etiquette of not littering is somehow prioritized over, the biological imperative of survival.
I am so glad we're starting here because it highlights the internal compass of our protagonist right away. She is a creature built entirely out of Victorian manners. I mean, even as she calculates this terrifying reality that she might fall right through the center of the earth, she attempts to practice her curtsy.
Yes, the curtsy.
She actually thinks to herself, "Fancy curtsying as you're falling through the air. Do you think you could manage it?" It captures something so universally human, I think.
Oh, definitely.
When you are thrust into these unprecedented, terrifying situations, say, I don't know, a massive corporate restructuring or a completely alien social environment, our brains often default to the most trivial conditioned rules we know just to maintain a sense of control.
The psychology of that moment is incredibly dense. To maintain that illusion of control, Alice obsessively reviews her geography lessons. She tries to calculate her latitude and longitude.
Even though she doesn't know what they mean.
Exactly. Carol notes that she has no idea what those grand words mean, but they sound impressive to say to herself. She begins to wonder if she'll fall all the way through the earth and come out in New Zealand or Australia.
And then we get this wonderful linguistic stumble.
Yeah. She wonders if she'll have to ask the people walking with their heads downward, the Antipodes, what the name of the country is. But her vocabulary fails her, and she calls them the Antipodes.
I want to pause on antipathies because a modern listener might just hear a mispronounced word and gloss right over it.
It's easy to miss.
Right. But the Antipodes literally refers to the direct opposite side of the globe. For a girl in England, that means Australia or New Zealand. But by substituting antipathies, which means deep-seated feelings of dislike or opposition, Carol is subtly foreshadowing the exact nature of the world she's about to enter.
Oh, that's a brilliant catch regarding the foreshadowing.
Yeah, everyone she meets down there will be antithetical to her logic, and they will treat her with immense antipathy.
Her fear of the Antipodes is twofold, really. First, you have the physical danger of the fall. But second, and far more terrifying to her, is the social danger of appearing uneducated.
The horror of seeming foolish.
Right. She decides not to ask the people the name of the country because they'll think she's an ignorant little girl.
Right.
She resolves to look for a sign instead. And as the fall continues, the sensory deprivation leads to this cognitive detachment. She gets sleepy. Her mind drifts to her cat, Dinah. And she begins asking this looping, rhythmic question, "Do cats eat bats? Do cats eat bats?"
And because no one is there to answer her, and because she possesses no empirical data on the dietary habits of either creature, the question just loses all semantic meaning.
It becomes a lullaby.
Exactly. She realizes that since she can't answer it, it doesn't really matter if she asks, do bats eat cats? It perfectly captures that specific twilight state of falling asleep where syntax just detaches from reality. But to really grasp why Alice's polite, rule-obsessed confusion is so revolutionary, we need to contextualize the era.
We really do.
Because the Victorian period was not exactly producing laid-back anarchic entertainment for children.
Oh, quite the opposite. Victorian children's literature was essentially an apparatus for moral conditioning. Books were these grim survival manuals, highly didactic and designed to instill obedience through the threat of severe consequence.
They were terrifying.
They were. The dominant formula of the era was rooted in this inescapable causality. If a child plays with matches, the child burns to death. If a child tells a lie, the child is socially ruined or suffers eternal damnation.
I mean, there are writers like Mary Martha Sherwood, who wrote the history of the Fairchild family. She literally featured scenes where parents take their squabbling children to see a corpse rotting on a gibbet just to teach them the consequences of familial discord.
Literature as a blunt instrument of trauma.
Yeah, exactly. Knowing that makes the very first page of Alice's adventure read like this radical manifesto. Alice is sitting on the bank, looking at the book her sister is reading, and she notes that it has no pictures or conversations.
Such a great line.
Her internal monologue is incredibly rebellious for a child of that era. She thinks, what is the use of a book without pictures or conversations? Before the white rabbit even appears, Alice is actively rebelling against the dry educational literature that was forced upon her demographic.
And Charles Dodgson, writing under the pen name Lewis Carroll, he entirely shared that rebellion. His broader project was to construct an environment completely devoid of those Victorian moral consequences. We see this thesis tested the absolute moment Alice lands and finds that little glass bottle.
The one with the paper label bearing the words drink me, beautifully printed in large letters.
Right. And the narration here is so specific about her conditioning. Alice is described as a wise little girl. She refuses to drink it immediately. She checks the label to see if it is marked poison.
And Carroll provides this incredibly wry commentary on why she checks.
He does. The text states she had read several nice little histories about children who had got burnt and eaten up by wild beasts and other unpleasant things, all because they would not remember the simple rules their friends had taught them.
The stories she knows basically mandate that if you drink much from a bottle marked poison, it is, as Carroll puts it, almost certain to disagree with you.
The British understatement of almost certain to disagree with you regarding lethal poison is magnificent.
It's so funny.
But look at the subversion of the trope here. The bottle is not marked poison. So, applying her Victorian logic, she deems it safe and drinks it. In any other book from 1865, a child drinking an unknown substance would result in a horrific lesson about gluttony or curiosity.
Right, she turned into a toad or something.
Exactly. Did she get eaten by a wild beast? No.
The contents just taste like a culinary fever dream. I mean, the book describes it as a mixed flavor of cherry tart, custard, pineapple, roast turkey, toffee, and hot buttered toast.
A very weird mix.
It sounds like a child's idealized holiday feast just blended into a single potion. She finishes it off and merely shrinks down to 10 inches high. No moral judgment is passed at all. She isn't punished for her curiosity. The physics of her world simply alter.
And that removal of a moral framework is deeply liberating from a literary standpoint. But, you know, we should consider the psychological impact on the protagonist. I wonder, does the absence of morality actually make the environment more terrifying?
How so?
Well, if there is no clear metric of good and bad, no cause and effect related to behavior, how does one navigate?
See, I sort of see it differently. I think the lack of a moral framework is the source of all her frustration, but I wouldn't call it terrifying, mainly because she just refuses to be terrified.
That's fair. She is very stubborn.
Rules, even oppressive didactic ones, provide a map, right? If you know touching the stove burns you, you can safely navigate the kitchen by avoiding the stove. When Alice shrinks and then subsequently finds a glass box containing a very small cake marked, "Eat me," she has no map.
She's flying blind.
Yeah. She eats the cake hoping it will make her grow. She's rolling the dice. She's relying on this new absurd premise that only out of the way things happen. There's no guarantee.
This absence of a predictable map fundamentally alters the narrative structure. I think modern audiences, particularly those raised on heavily sanitized or heroic adaptations, approach the source text expecting a traditional character arc.
Oh, absolutely. The classic hero's journey.
Right. You expect the protagonist receives a call to adventure, crosses the threshold, overcomes trials, slays a dragon, achieves self-actualization, and returns home with a prize.
That is the monomyth, and it has absolutely no place in Wonderland. If we chart the actual plot of this book, it's not a journey of conquest or personal growth. It's really just a grueling campaign of escalation and social frustration.
Let's trace that path to provide a clear orientation for everyone. The inciting sequence in that long, low Hall of Doors establishes the whole paradigm.
The locked doors.
Yeah. Alice is trapped in a space with many doors, all locked. She finds a tiny golden key that fits the door only 15 inches high, which leads to the loveliest garden she has ever seen. The goal is clear, right? Yeah. Get into the garden.
But her size prevents it.
Exactly. When she drinks the potion and shrinks, she realizes she left the key on the glass table, far out of her reach. And when she eats the cake to grow, she grows too large. It is a closed-loop puzzle designed to induce despair, not to test her virtue.
And from the Hall of Doors, she ends up swimming in a sea of her own tears. Tears she wept when she was 9 feet tall. She nearly drowns alongside a mouse and this bizarre collection of wet birds.
Just a terrible afternoon.
Truly. Then she is sent on an errand by the White Rabbit to his house, where she drinks another mysterious liquid, grows massive, and becomes physically wedged inside the architecture. She has one arm out the window and one foot up the chimney.
And the reaction of the creatures outside the rabbit's house is so telling. They don't view her as a magical anomaly. They view her as a logistical problem.
They're just annoyed.
Right. They try to burn the house down. They throw pebbles through the window, which magically turn into little cakes. Alice eats one, shrinks again, and flees into the woods. And there, she encounters the caterpillar on the mushroom, who basically subjects her to philosophical interrogation.
Which is exhausting. Following the caterpillar, she is thrust into the Duchess's kitchen. And this scene is, well, it's a sensory nightmare. The air is thick with pepper, causing everyone to sneeze violently.
Chaos.
Complete chaos. The cook is hurling fire irons and saucepans at the Duchess. And the Duchess is nursing a baby that is howling in pain while singing the sadistic lullaby about beating a child when it sneezes.
A very dark lullaby.
Yeah. Then the Duchess just tosses the baby to Alice, and as Alice carries it into the woods, the baby literally transforms into a pig. Alice just sets it down and watches it trot away.
Just another Tuesday in Wonderland. From there, the grinning Cheshire Cat directs her to the Mad Tea Party, which is a space of relentless conversational bullying orchestrated by the Hatter and the March Hare. Eventually, she does find her way into that beautiful garden she desired in Chapter 1.
But it's a trap.
Exactly. The garden is not a sanctuary.
No.
It is the domain of the Queen of Hearts, functioning as this impossible croquet ground, which eventually transitions into the chaotic, high-stakes trial of the Knave of Hearts.
What strikes me about this entire sequence of events is that the narrative engine relies solely on thwarting the protagonist. Every single time Alice applies logic, politeness, or her Victorian education to achieve a goal, the environment actively resists her.
It pushes back hard.
And the resistance isn't presented as some epic evil she must defeat. It's presented as pedantic bureaucracy.
Bureaucracy is the perfect word, which leads us to a crucial layer of context that modern listeners frequently gloss over. When we look at the talking animals, the magical food, and the shifting sizes, it's really easy to consume it as pure, unadulterated fantasy.
Just a whimsical dream.
But Alice's world is a warped funhouse mirror reflection of a Victorian schoolgirl's daily life. The entire book is a biting, systematic satire of rote education.
This is where the text transitions from being mildly amusing to genuinely brilliant. Alice is repeatedly traumatized by her changing size and her inability to control her surroundings. So to self-soothe, to prove to herself that she is still Alice, she attempts to recite the facts she has been forced to memorize in the schoolroom.
The comfort of facts.
Right. Mathematics, geography, moral poetry. But under the pressure of Wonderland, the rote facts just break down.
The breakdown is mathematical and geographical. While she's trapped in the Hall of Doors, she tries to recite her multiplication tables to verify her sanity. She says, 4 times 5 is 12, and 4 times 6 is 13, and 4 times 7 is, oh dear, I shall never get to 20 at that rate.
Which is so funny.
To a modern ear, this just sounds like a child making a mistake.
Yeah.
But Charles Dodgson was a mathematics lecturer at Christ Church, Oxford.
There is a deeply embedded logic here involving different number bases, but on a surface level, she's panicking because the foundation of her objective reality is crumbling.
Her geography fails her simultaneously. Right?
Yes. She says, London is the capital of Paris and Paris is the capital of Rome.
She realizes the dry facts hold no power here. And the absolute pinnacle of this educational satire occurs when Alice meets the Mock Turtle, We really have to slow down and unpack this scene because the puns are lethal and they just come at a relentless pace.
So many puns. The Mock Turtle is sitting on a rock, weeping heavily, and he begins recounting his days at school at the bottom of the sea.
He tells Alice that he took the regular course. The curriculum begins with reeling and writhing. The sonic proximity to reading and writing is obvious, but the physical implications, staggering around and twisting in pain, perfectly describe a child's physical experience of being forced to sit at a rigid school desk for hours.
That physical discomfort is so real.
Then he lists the different branches of arithmetic: ambition, distraction, uglification, and derision.
Addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. By replacing addition with ambition, Carol highlights the social climbing inherent in Victorian schooling. Subtraction becomes distraction. But uglification is just the masterpiece here.
Oh, absolutely.
When Alice asks what uglification is, the Griffin, who is sitting nearby, is deeply offended by her ignorance.
The Griffin uses pure, unassailable logic to shame her. He asks, "You know what to beautify is, I suppose." Alice cautiously agrees that it means to make anything prettier. The Griffin triumphantly concludes, "Well then, if you don't know what to uglify is, you are a simpleton."
I mean, you can't argue with it.
It is a flawless logical deduction based on a completely fabricated premise.
The curriculum continues. The Mock Turtle studied mystery, ancient and modern, with seography, history and geography. He studied drawing, stretching, and fainting in coils, which is a brutal takedown of drawing, sketching, and painting in oils, the polite decorative arts forced upon young women of Alice's class.
And finally, his classics master taught laughing and grief, standing in for Latin and Greek.
You really have to ask who the target of the satire actually is. Is Carol merely poking fun at a naive child who gets her vocabulary scrambled? Or is he launching a critique at the rigid institutional education system managed by adults?
Looking at the mechanics of the jokes, the target is unequivocally the adult system. Carol is exposing the utter emptiness of rote memorization. The facts are disconnected from any practical utility.
Right.
Consider the scene near the beginning. By the pool of tears, Alice, the mouse, and a collection of bizarre birds have just slammed ashore. They are freezing, dripping wet, and desperate to dry off. The mouse, assuming the role of an authoritative schoolmaster, demands their attention. He says, "Sit down, all of you, and listen to me. I'll soon make you dry enough."
And his solution to physical wetness is to recite a history textbook.
Yes.
He clears his throat and begins, "William the Conqueror, whose cause was favored by the Pope, was soon submitted to by the English, who wanted leaders and had been of late much accustomed to usurpation and conquest." It is a dense, impenetrable block of historical prose.
So boring.
When the lorrybird shivers, the mouse asks, "How are you getting on now, my dear?" Alice replies, "As wet as ever. It doesn't seem to dry me at all."
It is the ultimate pun on the word dry. The education they receive is completely devoid of warmth, utility, or emotional resonance. It is just dry facts.
And when the facts fail, the moralistic poetry fails too. Alice tries to recite Isaac Watts's famous poem, Against Idleness and Mischief, which was a staple of Victorian nurseries. It begins, "How doth the little busy bee improve each shining hour?" It was designed to teach children the value of hard work.
But when Alice opens her mouth, the words just mutate. The industrious moral bee is replaced by a predator. "How doth the little crocodile improve his shining tail and pour the waters of the Nile on every golden scale?"
A huge shift in tone.
Huge. The poem continues to describe how cheerfully the crocodile grins, how neatly he spreads his claws, and how he welcomes little fishes in with gently smiling jaws. The moral lesson of industry is completely obliterated, replaced by this dark Darwinian reality.
The polite society of the schoolroom just cannot survive the sheer predatory absurdity of Wonderland.
No, it can't. And that structural failure of education brings us to the deeper thematic architecture of the book. As we move through the text, there are specific tensions and motifs that define the companion conversation we are having. The first is undeniably the crisis of identity and size.
Alice's physical instability is basically the physical manifestation of psychological trauma. She grows to 9 feet tall, her head strikes the ceiling, she shrinks to 3 inches, she nearly drowns in her own tears.
The whiplash is intense.
This relentless resizing mirrors the specific, jarring turbulence of adolescence. You literally outgrow your environment, your body becomes unfamiliar, you feel clumsy, disproportionate, and perpetually out of place.
The scene that distills this crisis down to its purest essence is the encounter with a caterpillar. Alice approaches this large blue caterpillar resting on a mushroom, languidly smoking a long hookah.
Very iconic imagery.
V Very much so. The imagery is steeped in Victorian Orientalism, presenting an exotic, impassive figure of supposed wisdom. They stare at each other in silence for a long time. Finally, the caterpillar takes the hookah out of its mouth and asks her the ultimate philosophical question in a sleepy, almost hostile drawl. Who are you?
It is a profound question, and Alice is completely unequipped to answer it. She replies haltingly, I hardly know, sir. Just at present, at least I know who I was when I got up this morning, but I think I must have been changed several times since then.
She ties her identity entirely to her physical consistency.
Right. Because her body has changed, she assumes her core self has also changed.
And the caterpillar, acting as this relentless interrogator, demands she explain herself. Alice, trying to maintain her politeness while deeply frustrated, says, I can't explain myself, I'm afraid, sir, because I'm not myself, you see. The caterpillar flatly replies, I don't see.
It's a masterclass in conversational stonewalling.
What makes this exchange so compelling is the caterpillar's complete rejection of her premise. Alice assumes that physical transformation naturally leads to a crisis of identity. She projects her anxiety onto him, saying, when you have to turn into a chrysalis, you will someday, you know, and then after that into a butterfly, I should think you'll feel it a little queer, won't you?
She wants him to validate her feelings.
She's seeking solidarity in the experience of metamorphosis. And the caterpillar, a creature whose entire biological destiny is defined by radical physical transformation, replies, not a bit.
He is impervious to the anxiety of change. For Alice, the inconsistency of her physical form and her failing memory equals the death of the self. She relies on external data to prove she exists.
She really does.
Earlier, when weeping in the pool of tears, she genuinely wonders if she's been swapped in the night with another girl. She runs through the list of her friends, trying to determine if she has become one of them. She concludes she cannot be Ada because Ada's hair falls in ringlets and Alice's doesn't.
But Mabel.
Right. She fears she might be Mabel, a girl who she thinks knows very little. She decides, if I'm Mabel, I'll stay down here. She would literally rather remain trapped in a subterranean well than live as an uneducated child.
This crisis reaches an extraordinary peak of absurdity shortly after she leaves the caterpillar. She takes a bite from the right side of the mushroom and her neck stretches with immense velocity.
Oh, this scene.
She shoots up into the canopy of the trees. Her head is so far above her body that she loses sight of her own shoulders and hands. Her neck is bending about like a serpent. And in the foliage, she is violently attacked by a pigeon.
The pigeon sequence is a brilliant exploration of how identity is thrust upon us by others. The pigeon has been exhaustively guarding her eggs against serpents. When she sees Alice's massive, sinuous neck breaking through the leaves, she panics and screams, "Serpent!"
Which is a fair assumption given the neck.
Right. But Alice is highly indignant. She insists she is a little girl. But the pigeon is not interested in Alice's internal truth. She is operating on a strict defensive logic.
The pigeon employs a flawless, yet fundamentally flawed syllogism. She says, I suppose you'll be telling me next that you never tasted an egg. Alice, bound by her Victorian commitment to honesty, admits that she has tasted eggs, noting that little girls eat eggs quite as much as serpents do.
And the trap closes?
The pigeon seizes on this data point. If they do, why, then they're a kind of serpent. That's all I can say.
It is a logical fallacy affirming the consequent. If a serpent eats eggs and a little girl eats eggs, therefore a little girl is a serpent. The pigeon defines Alice entirely by external, arbitrary data points that threaten the pigeon's worldview.
Her internal identity doesn't matter at all.
Because Alice has a long neck and consumes eggs, her internal identity as a little girl is irrelevant. To the pigeon, she is functionally a serpent and must be treated as a threat.
If the physical body is unstable and identity is arbitrarily assigned by hostile strangers, the only tool Alice has left is language. But that brings us to the second major motif woven through the text, the breakdown of language and time.
Oh.
In Wonderland, words do not clarify, they obfuscate. They are slippery, pedantic weapons used to assert dominance.
Which brings us to the most famous social gathering in literature, the Mad Tea Party. Alice approaches a table set out under a tree. The Hatter, the March Hare, and a sleeping dormouse are crowded together at one corner. As Alice approaches, they immediately shout, "No room, no room," even though the table is massive and largely empty.
Such a rude welcome.
It is an immediate, unprovoked assertion of territorial hostility. Alice sits down anyway in a large armchair. The March Hare offers her wine. Alice looks around and observes there is no wine. The Hare cheerfully notes there isn't any.
Mind games from the start.
Alice points out that it wasn't very civil of him to offer it, The hare counters that it wasn't very civil of her to sit down without being invited.
From the very first breath, the social contract is weaponized. They are not exchanging pleasantries. They are probing for weaknesses in her syntax. The Hatter then asks his legendary riddle, why is a raven like a writing desk?
Alice is delighted here, though.
She is. She thinks they're finally going to play a structured game. She announces she believes she can guess it. The March Hare asks, do you mean that you think you can find out the answer to it? Alice says, exactly so, and the hare drops the trap. Then you should say what you mean.
This exchange feels incredibly modern. Alice tries to defend herself, saying, I do, at least I mean what I say. That's the same thing, you know? And the Hatter relentlessly attacks the logical equivalence of that statement. Not the same thing a bit. You might just as well say that I see what I eat is the same thing as I eat what I see.
The pile-on begins.
Exactly. The March Hare jumps in, piling on the logic puzzle. You might just as well say that I like what I get is the same thing as I get what I like.
Even the Dormouse, seemingly asleep, mumbles into the fray. You might just as well say that I breathe when I sleep is the same thing as I sleep when I breathe.
Reading this dialogue, it struck me that the Mad Tea Party operates exactly like a toxic internet comment section.
Oh, that is a highly accurate comparison. Consider the mechanics of both environments.
In both spaces, everyone is talking past each other. The participants are hyper-focused on pedantry, syntax, and grammar, deliberately misinterpreting plain English to score points in an argument that has no actual stakes.
It's all about scoring points.
Alice is attempting to engage in a good faith conversation. She assumes the goal of communication is understanding. The Hatter and the Hare are engaging in bad faith communication. They're basically trolling her by pointing out logical fallacies that are technically true but entirely irrelevant to the social grace of her statement.
They are violating Grice's maxims of conversation, the unspoken rules that we will be truthful, relevant, and clear when we speak to one another. They use the rigid rules of formal logic not to build bridges, but to construct walls and assert intellectual dominance over a child.
And they apply this exact same destructive literalism to the concept of time.
The discussion of time at the tea party is mind-bending. The Hatter pulls out a pocket watch, looks at it uneasily, shakes it, and holds it to his ear. He asks Alice what day of the month it is. She says the 4th. The Hatter sighs, 2 days wrong.
He blames the butter.
Yes, he blames the March Hare for putting butter in the works. The Hare defends himself by saying it was the best butter. The Hatter points out that crumbs must have gotten in as well because the Hare used the bread knife to apply it.
The absurdity of using butter as a mechanical lubricant is wonderful, but the conceptual shift happens when Alice notes that the watch tells the day of the month, but not what o'clock it is. She asks why it should. Does your watch tell you what year it is?
And the Hatter mutters that it doesn't because it stays the same year for a long time.
Alice states that is a completely different situation. The Hatter bafflingly replies, which is just the case with mine. Alice is forced to admit she feels dreadfully puzzled because his words have no sort of meaning in them, yet they are spoken in perfectly correct English.
So Alice tries a different tactic. She suggests they could do something better with the time than waste it, asking riddles that have no answers. The Hatter seizes upon her phrasing. If you knew time as well as I do, you wouldn't talk about wasting it. It's him.
Time is no longer an abstract concept or a measurement. Time is personified as a masculine entity.
Exactly. The Hatter explains that he quarreled with time last March, just before the March Hare went mad. The Hatter was required to sing at a grand concert given by the Queen of Hearts. He chose to sing a parody of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
And the lyrics are, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Bat, how I wonder what you're at. Up above the world you fly like a tea tray in the sky. Which brings us right back to Alice's Do Cats Eat Bats musings from the well.
It does. But the performance ended in disaster. The Queen didn't appreciate the tempo. She bawled out, he's murdering the time, off with his head. And because the Queen used that specific foul speech, murdering the time, the entity known as time took profound offense.
He took it literally.
The Hatter explains, and ever since that, he won't do a thing I ask. It's always 6 o'clock now.
The physics of their reality broke because a metaphor was taken literally. They are permanently trapped at tea time. They have no time to wash the dishes, so they are forced to simply keep moving around the circular table as the tea things get used up, leaving a trail of dirty cups in their wake.
It's a grim existence.
Language has physical consequences in Wonderland, and poor communication leads to eternal stasis.
The breakdown of language and the manipulation of time are tools of power, which leads directly into the third major thematic focus, The absurdity of authority.
This is a big one.
If the Mad Tea Party demonstrates the collapse of social discourse, the Queen's croquet ground and the subsequent trial expose the complete fragility and inherent violence of adult justice and governance.
Because Alice finally manages to unlock the tiny door and enter the beautiful garden. And immediately, the illusion of paradise is shattered. She finds three gardeners, whose bodies are flat and rectangular like playing cards, frantically painting a white rose tree with red paint.
Trying to fix a mistake before it's fatal.
Alice politely asks why they are doing this. Two, the gardener, explains that they accidentally planted a white rose tree instead of a red one. If the queen finds out, she will have all their heads cut off. The garden is maintained through sheer, unadulterated terror.
The royal procession arrives, a sweeping parade of playing card soldiers, courtiers, and royal children, culminating with the King and Queen of Hearts. The Queen spots the gardeners, who have thrown themselves flat on their faces. She turns to Alice and demands, "Who is this?" And then she points at the prostrate gardeners and asks, "And who are these?"
Alice experiences a sudden surge of courage here. She realizes they are only a pack of cards and she needn't be afraid of them. She tells the queen, "How should I know? It's no business of mine."
The queen's reaction is instantaneous.
She turns crimson with fury, glares at Alice like a wild beast, and screams, "Off with her head! Off!"
But Alice does not cower. She simply says, loudly and decidedly, "Nonsense." And the queen is silenced. It is a pivotal moment. It is the first structural crack in the authority of Wonderland. Alice asserts her own logical boundary against an unreasonable command, and the authoritarian figure blinks first.
The queen pivots to playing croquet, but it is the ultimate rigged system. It is a game designed to be impossible to play fairly. The croquet ground is deeply ridged and furrowed, the balls are live hedgehogs, the mallets are live flamingos, and the arches are the playing card soldiers who have to double themselves over and stand on their hands and feet.
The underlying mechanism of the absurdity here is the instrumentalization of living creatures. The rules of the game require biological entities with their own agency to act as inanimate objects. The physical comedy of the text is meticulous.
It's hilarious to picture.
Alice attempts to tuck her flamingo under her arm. But every time she gets his neck straightened out to strike the hedgehog, the flamingo twists his head around and looks up into her face with a puzzled expression. By the time she subdues the bird, the hedgehog has unrolled itself and crawled away. Furthermore, the arches, the soldiers, are continually standing up and walking to other parts of the ground.
There are no turns. Everyone plays at once, shouting and fighting over the hedgehogs. The queen rushes about, stamping her foot and shouting, "Off with his head!" or "Off with her head!" about once a minute. The management style is pure chaos, governed entirely by volume and intimidation.
But the intimidation is largely performative. Later, when Alice is introduced to the griffin, the creature dismisses the queen's threats entirely. He tells Alice, "What fun. It's all her fancy that they never executes nobody, you know."
So it's all an act.
The entire structure of authority is an elaborate, violent piece of performance art disguised as governance.
This performative justice culminates in the trial of the Knave of Hearts, accused of stealing the Queen's tarts. If you ever need a text to explain the farcical nature of institutional bureaucracy, the trial scene is it. The King of Hearts serves as the judge, and he's wearing his crown balanced over his massive judge's wig, which Carol specifically notes is a very uncomfortable and unflattering arrangement.
The jury is composed of various animals and birds, and they're hopelessly incompetent. Before the trial even begins, they are busily writing their own names on their slate because they are terrified they will forget them before the end of the proceedings.
Poor Bill the Lizard.
Yes. One juror, Bill the Lizard, has a pencil that squeaks gratingly on the slate. Alice, unable to stand the noise, sneaks up behind him and confiscates the pencil. Bill, lacking the cognitive flexibility to ask for another, simply continues to write with his finger for the rest of the day, leaving absolutely no mark on the slate.
The evidence gathering is a masterclass in obfuscation. They call the Hatter as the first witness. He arrives holding a teacup and a piece of bread and butter, still trapped in his eternal tea time. The king commands him, "Give your evidence and don't be nervous or I'll have you executed on the spot."
Not exactly calming.
This does not inspire confidence. The Hatter is so terrified he bites a large chunk out of his teacup instead of his bread. He babbles incoherently about the March hare and the twinkling of the tea. He provides zero factual information regarding the stolen tarts. The king solemnly tells the jury to write that down.
During this chaos, Alice begins to physically grow larger again. The king notices this and realizes she is becoming a threat to his authority. So, mid-trial, he writes something in his notebook and calls out, "Silence." He then reads from his book, Rule 42. All persons more than a mile high to leave the court.
Alice immediately spots the corruption. She states she is not a mile high. The king insists she is. The queen claims she is nearly 2 miles high. Alice refuses to leave, and she attacks the procedural integrity of the court. She tells the king, "That's not a regular rule. You invented it just now."
The king, caught in a lie, claims it is the oldest rule in the book.
And Alice applies pure, devastating logic. Then it ought to be number one. The king shuts his notebook, trembling.
The tension here is foundational. Alice is demanding logical consistency and due process from a system that is entirely constructed upon arbitrary whims and retroactive justification.
The trial hinges on a piece of paper presented as a letter written by the prisoner, though it is not in his handwriting and has no signature. The White Rabbit reads the contents, which is a completely disjointed, nonsensical poem. "They told me you had been to her and mentioned me to him. She gave me a good character, but said I could not swim."
There are no names. There are no facts. There is no narrative.
None. The knave correctly points out that he didn't sign it. The king delivers a stunning piece of circular logic. "If you didn't sign it, that only makes the matter worse. You must have meant some mischief, or else you'd have signed your name like an honest man."
The absence of evidence of a crime is treated as definitive proof of a conspiracy to commit a crime.
The king then attempts to forcefully interpret the meaningless poem to fit the predetermined crime. He reads the line, "I gave her one, they gave him two," and triumphantly declares, "Why, that must be what he did with the tarts, you know." He forces meaning onto a void.
And the queen, tired of the charade of due process, demands the ultimate subversion of justice. Sentence first, verdict afterwards.
And that is the breaking point. The linguistic and logical chaos becomes so dense that Alice simply cannot tolerate it anymore. But before we discuss how she shatters that reality, we have to look at the medium through which this chaos is delivered. The text we have been analyzing is inherently an oral tradition, and experiencing it through a Clarinoratio audiobook fundamentally changes the listener's relationship to the text.
It is vital to remember the origins of the story. Charles Dodgson improvised this tale aloud on a golden afternoon in 1862, while rowing a boat up the River Thames with three young girls, one of whom was the real-life Alice Liddell.
Right.
The story was built to be spoken, to be performed, to rely on the cadence and rhythm of a live storyteller.
When you read the book silently, you have the luxury of pacing. You can pause. You can reread a complex sentence. You can visually analyze the structure of a joke. But in an audio performance, you are thrust into the immediate rushing flow of the dialogue.
You experience Alice's confusion in real time, exactly as she does. The auditory wordplay becomes a visceral experience rather than an intellectual exercise.
The most famous example is The Mouse's Tale. In the printed book, the mouse offers to tell a long, sad tale regarding his history. Alice, gazing at the mouse's physical appendage, assumes he is talking about his tail.
E-A-I-L.
On the page, Carol accommodates the visual reader by formatting the text of the poem to physically curve, shrink, and snake down the page, visually mimicking a mouse's tail.
But when you listen to the audiobook, you are stripped of that visual aid. You hear the narrator playing the mouse say, "Mine is a long and a sad tale." And you hear Alice reply, "It is a long tale, certainly, but why do you call it sad?"
For a split second, the listener shares Alice's cognitive dissonance.
Yes, you experience the phonetic collision of the homophones precisely as the characters do. The pun is not a visual trick. It is an auditory reality.
Furthermore, the text is saturated with songs, parodies, and recitations that demand vocal performance. Consider the Mock Turtle singing Beautiful Soup. The printed text provides the lyrics, but it also includes explicit stage directions. Carol writes that the Mock Turtle sighs deeply and begins to sing in a voice sometimes choked with sobs.
A narrator cannot simply read those lyrics flatly. They must embody the tragic, hysterical weeping of a mythological creature crying over a bowl of soup. Beautiful soup, soup of the evening, beautiful, beautiful soup.
The audio format forces the bizarre juxtaposition of deep, traumatic, melancholy, and utter ridiculous nonsense right into your ears. It transforms flat text into a chaotic, multi-tonal symphony of contrasting personalities.
The trial scene is an auditory tour de force in this regard. A skilled narrator must manage the shrill, violent commands of the queen, the timid, fumbling, nervous voice of the king, the anxious, hurried delivery of the White Rabbit, and Alice's own voice, which shifts from polite and confused early in the book to bold, full-voiced, and fiercely defiant by the end.
The madness of Wonderland is not just defined by what the characters say, but by the relentless, overwhelming sound of how they say it.
which perfectly frames the final question of our exploration today. We have mapped the escalation of absurdity. We have unpacked the historical satire of Victorian rote education. We have explored the instability of identity, the weaponization of language, and the farcical nature of authority.
But what does this book actually say to us now? What is the modern resonance if we refuse to flatten it into the cliche of a trippy psychedelic dream?
The true resonance of Alice's journey is a masterclass in psychological resilience. It is a guide to surviving in a post-truth environment. Throughout the entire ordeal, Alice is besieged. The adults around her scream nonsense. They threaten her with physical violence. They contradict themselves constantly.
They use language not to communicate, but to confuse and subjugate her.
Yet, remarkably, Alice never completely loses her grip on her own internal logic.
She experiences moments of profound despair. She weeps until she creates a literal pool of tears. She argues, she gets frustrated, but she never surrenders her reality to theirs. When the Queen demands the sentence before the verdict, Alice doesn't cower or try to rationalize the irrational. She calls it out plainly. Stuff and nonsense, the idea of having the sentence first.
She holds the line. And as the trial reaches its absolute peak of authoritarian absurdity, as the King and Queen try to execute her for the crime of pointing out their logical fallacies, Alice experiences a revelation. She has grown to her full, towering size. She looks down at this terrifying, violent, chaotic court, and she suddenly sees them for what they actually are.
The Queen screams, "Off with her head!" And the cards rise up into the air and fly down upon her. And Alice, fully empowered by her own unshakable reality, strikes them down with the most devastating critique possible. She declares, "Who cares for you? You're nothing but a pack of cards."
It is an unparalleled moment of empowerment. She recognizes that the institutions, the authority figures, the rigid and terrifying rules of this society, they are fundamentally paper thin. They possess no inherent power over her other than the power she voluntarily grants them by agreeing to play their rigged game.
The moment she withdraws her consent, the moment she identifies the structure as a fragile construct of playing cards, the threat dissolves and she wakes up.
It is a profoundly validating narrative for anyone navigating the complexities of modern life. It grants you permission to realize that sometimes the sprawling institutions around you, whether it is a labyrinthine corporate bureaucracy, a toxic algorithm on social media, or simply a group of unreasonable, aggressive people demanding you speak their jargon, are genuinely just making it up as they go along.
You are allowed to look at a rigged system, point out the logical fallacies, declare that it is just a pack of cards, and walk away.
You are not obligated to play croquet with flamingos. You are not required to debate a hatter who uses logic to avoid communication. You have the right to reject the fundamental premise of the absurdity.
So as we conclude this companion conversation, I want to leave you with a specific thought to carry forward. Consider the environments in your own life. How often do you exhaust yourself trying to apply good faith logic to situations that are fundamentally run by mad hatters and queens of hearts?
How much energy do you spend trying to decipher the rules of a game that was explicitly designed to have no rules at all?
It is a draining endeavor. Sometimes the most logical, rational action you can take in a fiercely illogical world is to simply refuse to participate in the nonsense. Wake up from the dream!
But when you are ready to purposefully embrace the nonsense, when you want to experience the unhinged, brilliant, chaotic wordplay of Charles Dodgson in all its performed glory, we extend a warm invitation to return to the Clara Narratio audiobook of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
It offers an incredibly rich, visceral listening experience. The story is always there, waiting for you to tumble down the rabbit hole. Just remember, as you fall past the bookshelves and the maps, to ask yourself, do cats eat bats?
And if they do, is the jar of marmalade empty?
We will leave that for you to figure out. Thanks for joining us in Wonderland.